Good afternoon. Welcome to Turnout Radio on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Nicole Inika Hamilton, back to open up with you about the latest on the dance scene and the heart of what moves us. It is so good, as always, to be back with you. Happy holidays and season's greetings, folks. I'm sending you all the love and light as we begin our program today. Welcome to this dance space. Well, as we enter into the space together, I invite you to wrap yourself in all that you need this afternoon as we explore today's conversation. Coming up on the broadcast, I will be sitting down with Associate Professor Jennifer Nicolai and Arts Educator Laurel Nicolai. The sisters will be opening up about creating community through song and dance, variations on brain dance themes. So stay tuned and stay locked in right here on CIUT 89.5 FM. We're going to take a break and be right back with Jennifer and Laurel. Welcome back to Turnout Radio. I'm Nicole Inika Hamilton. Joining me on the show today, Associate Professor Jennifer Nicolai, PhD, is a performer and performance studies scholar. Live, improvised, and digital dramaturgical approaches inform her research objectives through improvisational inquiry in performance and community-based contexts. She is joined by her sister, Laurel Nicolai, who is an arts educator who has taught students from pre-K through to graduate students. Her teaching career has spanned Canada, Switzerland, and the United Arab Emirates. Laurel holds her Master of Education degree from the University of Alberta, where she has taught courses in music and dance pedagogy. Join me in welcoming both to Turnout Radio. Welcome, Jennifer and Laurel. How are you doing?
Fabulous. Thank you, Nicole. And sending you season's greetings as well.
Oh, well, I received them. I received them. Thank you. I appreciate that, Jennifer. How are you doing, Laurel?
Good. It is so nice to see you again, Nicole, and to be here with my sister in person, and just really grateful to have the chance to have this conversation with you.
Well, I'm standing in some gratitude, too. I recently had the opportunity to meet you both at the 2024 Healthy Dancer Canada conference, where you both had presented. And it was such a not only was it a wonderful presentation, but we also had a post chat, which was equally wonderful. And so I'm thrilled today to welcome you both to Turnout Radio.
The gratitude that Laurel shares, I share that same sentiment. I've recently, as a Canadian citizen, returned back to live in Canada after being overseas for 22 years. So that in itself is returning not only to my home of ancestry and origin, but also to return to reflecting and reevaluating my dance research and practice in the context now of living in Canada. I'm specifically living in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. And previously, where a lot of my research was more internationally or globally inclined, but I did also focus specifically on my direct community in Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland, in Aotearoa, New Zealand. I was constantly doing international research in Canada. And so my gratitude is that I'm now returning back to my place of origin and I'm conducting domestic research, continuing with those through lines from the gifts that I was given in New Zealand, but continuing those through lines now in Canada. And that in itself feels like it's fantastic timing as I land and return back to where my ancestors, raised me, raised our family, raised our loved ones. And so that is an extra layer to my gratitude right now in December of 2024.
How has that been for you as well, Laurel, as you hear your sister share about the return back to Canada?
You know, it has been challenging for us being apart for so many years. We grew up spending so much time together and honestly, mostly through dance. That was our common place. We lived at the dance studio. We had common friends through that. That really was our place. And we each moved to different countries through university to study. And then when I moved back from France, we lived together and it was incredible. But then Jennifer moved to Vancouver to continue. And so then I moved to Dubai. And it has been many years since we've been in the same country. So really last time we both lived in the prairies was when we were in our early 20s. And it has been something missing. And so when Jennifer knew she was relocating to Canada, and she said, okay, we're going to start writing together, researching together, presenting together, we both had to leave dance in our lives to come back to it later. And it's almost like with us, we have had to be in different places to set up our lives. And now we're able to come back together.
And you say, Laurel, that you had to leave dance to come back together. Explore that for me, please.
You know, we grew up with very intense ballet training. That really was all our lives were. It seemed, I mean, of course, we did other things too, but we would dance 5 to 7 days a week, 4 hours a day. And, weekends were spent full rehearsals. And really, that was our teenage years, which we loved. But I know Jennifer sustained some injuries at the end of her high school time. And for me, it would have never been my path to continue dancing. And I think what was very hard for both of us that time, it was all or nothing. So you either are dancing and you become a professional dancer or you quit completely. And so that we had to leave it, but it never leaves you. And I'll let Jennifer speak to her story, how she came back to dance. And as people will know from her bio, she's a dance academic. For me, I came back to dance through music education and realized that not every music teacher is a dancer. And not everyone in Western music education has made the connection between body, dance, and music. And for me, I realized this was a gift I could share with people that comes very naturally. I also later in life found ways to dance again, perform again, work through injuries, and so on. So yeah, it's one of those great losses, actually, leaving dance, but knowing it's always in you.
Always in you, moving, transforming, and shifting at times through careers and life journey.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, I mean, Laurel, I definitely share your sentiment. Laurel and I had the privilege of having access to ballet training at that moment in history, being in the city that we were in, that absolutely supported our artistic training. So not only did we have fine ballet teachers, ballet training, but we had character and jazz, so fine jazz teachers, absolutely fantastic, and modern dance teachers and dance history and context. And we went to a fine and performing arts high school in order to complete our academics in the morning and train all afternoon and evening. So that model in itself is absolutely extraordinary, and it profoundly shifted who we are. And as Laurel refers to us as having it in our, so Laurel said it's in us, so it's in our bones, it's in our cellular composition. And that never leaves. But being an 18-year-old who's training as an elite dancer in the 1980s and 90s, though that time, place, and circumstance didn't necessarily support us and fellow peers who, once we completed what we did in high school and didn't have the opportunity to join a professional company. So in my instance, it was due to injury. I would say qualitatively that the scene, the time, place, circumstance scene has shifted. It's part of what Laurel and I talk about in regards to supporting our young people, supporting dancers present day, supporting our own children and nieces around finding a way to sustain healthy artistic practice that traverses injury, aging, life circumstances, where choices now, I would say or hope, are a lot more flexible for dancers or those that are training and obsessed and passionate about, right? That it's not dichotomous, right? It's not a this or that. Laurel and I having the this or that in that time and place in history has led us, quite honestly, to careers where we use the term variation on the brain dance theme in the title of our first of many presentations, sisterly presentations. But, you know, the concept of the variation on the theme, I think, is really adept to how we also see practicing as educators present day, reflecting on where we've come from and the arc of where we also would love to continue to support, mentor, promote for future artists, practitioners, educators as well.
The sustainability of art practices is something I'd like to revisit as I was listening to you share, Jennifer. I'm curious to know, as you both have explored that particular area of sustainability, what have you discovered for each of yourselves about sustainability as it pertains to even your own care within your individual practices? What have you discovered, and what has served you?
So what's interesting for me was the discovery of creative dance, which is part of really music education, and due to the connection with the Orff Schulwerk, and that having started as a movement in the 1920s when modern dance and the gymnastics movement and all the rest, and dancers were looking to become musical. And so this is where we have the Schulwerk that developed with Gunil Keatman and Karl Orff. And at the heart of all of that is creativity, and that everybody adds their own improvisation, which leads to composition, and that idea of creativity. So when I discovered the world of creative dance in music education and through music education, I realized that there were so many ways that my body could move that felt so good, that were natural to, again, my body and whatever stage of life it was in, that I could feel the beauty and freedom of moving without it being good enough, or this way or right. It just was the joy of being able to express myself through how my body could move. And I've been able to give adults who have always wanted to move and wanted to dance, and but said, yeah, I was never a dancer. I never trained in dancer. And turning adults into realizing, oh, actually, everybody is a dancer. And then now sharing that with students, that this is part of how we express ourselves as humans. We dance. And it is there for everybody. So really, that was kind of my moment and way of finding, a way of moving that worked for my body and my situation.
Well, I think there's a freedom in that, isn't there, Laurel? In knowing that we have this wonderful opportunity through dance to just be, without that this construct of having it feel like it needs to be structured. And so there's a freedom that comes to mind as I was listening to your share.
You know, and someone who trained in a lot of technique, but absolutely does not have a flexible back. For instance, ballet was never going to be my path. But realizing that, you know, the gift I have to jump and turn and fly and switch, you know, all of this, how much I can do rather than what I can't do. So I think that is the joy. It comes from what can you do? And as we look at inclusivity in schools and accessibility to all people, realizing dance is for everybody, just as music is for everybody. It, the idea that we have, that we are consumers of music and dance, that we observe them and we clap for them and we are part of an audience versus we are part of the music and dance making, it is a shift that I think is really important, because we know that it is good for our brains, it is good for our bodies to make music and dance with other humans, and it is part of being human, and it's not saved for a special elite few. It is for everybody.
And your thoughts, Jennifer?
Yeah, I share the value that dance commands inclusivity, that we are all dancers. And although we came from a private sector training in that period of time in history, I would say that we both deeply believe in public education, inclusive education, where all of us are making and playing together. And so Laurel's narrative that music took her into a place of appreciation and creating new connections. My narrative transition essentially happened through my discovery of theater. So my undergraduate degree was in drama or theater, and I discovered making play and improvising through storytelling and character development and absurd connections that we make in the moment. And I became immediately attracted to the concept of improvisation and making and devising through putting ourselves in scenarios with one another. And so Laurel seeing the connection and the joy in dance through musical opportunities, I in my career created those through dramatic opportunities. So it is drama that brought me back to dance. And specifically, I'd say being a drama teacher in the community and the recreational sector. So not being attracted to a private sector, but I was most attracted to recreational community classes, school classes with children in school spaces, big spaces, all of us just being joyful together, finding ourselves talking and laughing and making up stories and dancing, and that then led me into returning back to the joy and the possibilities of dance and dance education as well.
Thank you. Jennifer and Laurel, I've been doing a lot of research and reading about the variations and the power of play as it pertains to us as adults. Very often what I've been reading in my explorations is that sometimes play seems to be reserved for children. And the discovery of knowing that it's also for us as adults, a pathway to many different healing measures. And so in meeting the both of you, what I did notice is this beautiful sister relationship, but also this playful relationship that you both have.
It's interesting you mention that play and noticing the playfulness between us. I think when we grew up, we didn't need anybody else because we had each other and we had our dress-up box and we had our playhouse and we had our forest and we had our craft box. And so I think we maybe it was when we grew up in the 70s and 80s that this is all we had to play with. But I think there was something more. We always created together. And, you know, when you think about play as children and play as adults, that Jennifer and I have both mentioned improvisation. I mean, we were very, very good at entering into the world of make-believe in these wild scenarios that would last days, weeks, might I even say years on end, which is what is amazing with play. And that somehow has come to be as adults. You know, we as teenagers then, if there was music on, we're like, oh, let's make up a dance. Oh, let's do this. Let's create this photo op. Let's write a different forms of play as we went through. And our whole lives, I would even say how we interact with people. We have this joke that when we're together, it's like we have this confidence to go up to strangers and almost just play in these scenarios. So it is interesting you say that, because as humans, we are very playful together. And I think that probably is because we just learned how to feed off of each other's creativity and improvise together. And the rules of improvisation, we knew by, you know, offer and accept, and there we go. And we, as adults, we do that.
I love that you say that, Laurel. Nicole, recently, it was probably last year, it was December at this time, Laurel and I both took an adult dance class in the community close to us. And the dance teacher asked us all to go into a contact improvisation opportunity. And Laurel and I found each other. And I'm not exaggerating when we say, I think we could have been in that contact improvisation for an hour without any interruption, and you could have heard us giggle. So the, you know, the combination of us just having this amazing opportunity to play, and just not stop and not be censored and not, right? Yes, of course, we heard the prompts and the cues. So that's, you know, that's my direct example of a moment where I think we were just lost in our own joyfulness. But yes, both Laurel and I think, find in each other a conduit towards play. And I think we also invite one another to research play, to integrate play into our pedagogy, be that with toddlers or with adults that are, you know, I would say adults. I've worked with adults in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, where I am most joyfully playing with them theatrically. And Laurel, I think we share that through the shared experience of childhood, where the two of us lived in the same home at the same time, and we're constantly in make-believe with one another.
Jennifer is the most playful mother I've ever met. Like, she's there playing grounders in the playground and in everything, and really enters the world of make-believe with children at just out of pleasure, work aside. But you know, we also have said that when we're together, we're very much yes, let's people. If one of us suggests, do you want to go do this? There is never a time that one of us would say, I'm not up for it. It's like, okay, and what's the possibility? And we always know that if we're together, something fun's going to happen. But I think there must be a level of comfort that we're very comfortable taking risks in each other's presence. And that goes back even to that dance improvisation. We're very comfortable together and very, maybe we just know we'll catch the other one if they need it. We're there, someone's always there for you, but to improvise, you have to feel safe. To play, you have to be ready to let go of all your inhibitions. And really, we're very fortunate that we have that.
I can respect what Laurel said, absolutely. But also, I'd love to reflect on observing Laurel as a pedagogue. So when I'm observing Laurel conducting a workshop with fellow music and movement arts-based educators, I observe her taking her yes lets into a context where she ignites that in other adults that haven't spent their lives with us, right? So Laurel, I say you take that into your professional context, into your pedagogical contexts. And likewise, when I'm teaching as an academic, when I'm teaching my undergraduates, so my Bachelor of Dance students who are 19 years old, I very easily envisage that I'm with Laurel when I'm conducting a playful improvisation for an hour and a half or 2 hours, right? So the yes lets from the trust that is here on the home front taken into the classroom, I'd say that creates an echo of, I can do this in the classroom. I've done it with Laurel and I observe Laurel doing it. And so I'd say, in that manner, Laurel, you've mentored me to be able to confidently take that into adult improvisation and adult play, watching you with toddlers, watching you with young people, watching you even with fellow educators and your young people.
And, I'm going to give our mother credit for this. She has 3 grandchildren and they all say she's like not even a 12-year-old, a 5-year-old. And I think maybe we just come from a very playful household. Our mother is really silly a lot of the time, really silly. Especially when she's with our children. And she's little, she's this tiny, she's not even 5 feet, but she's a little ball of fire. And she is 80 and plays with her teenage and adult grandchildren and lets them be silly with her. So we probably actually just always had that.
As you do reflect on these shared experiences, improvisation and being lost in play, how have those shared experiences informed each of your practices?
So for me, it was really interesting learning about the world of play through theory. And that was, so I started my master's degree when my girls were 9 months old. We moved back to Canada. And the first class that I had, so my girls were born in Dubai, they were 9 months old, week later started grad school. And my first class was in early childhood musical play. And that is when I was exposed to the world of early childhood and research on play and all the play theories. And in the meanwhile, I had these 2 children that I could observe. And because they were the same age as each other too, I really took the research I was learning and observed my children and watched this and looked to nourish it, setting up these playful environments. And, it's like you joke about the psychologist whose children are the experiments. I have all these videos of my children in their musical play. But it was really neat knowing what to look for. And honestly, prior to having my own children, as much as I am a playful human, I think very different probably from my sister, who always was fascinated with that. But I'm like, oh, yeah, they're fine. This isn't my favorite age to teach. And then when I started learning the research and observing my own children and their play, I really realized the magic of young children and their play and their brilliance, and how as an educator and an education system, we actually need to learn from the model of what we know from early childhood education, and that needs to carry through. And we never lose that need for play. But somehow we think that as soon as, you know, we teach, we reach the age of 9, 10, 11 and up, it should, you know, all be serious. And so really, I tell people I have the best job in the world because I get to play with puppets and sing and dance and play with props all day, you know. So really, it has been a gift. And I was really lucky to take that class in musical play and then work with the professor, Dr. Kathy Smith, who then did her doctorate in that. We set up an early childhood musical play center. So she became the director of the Child Study Center at the U of A. It no longer exists. U of T is the only one that still has a Child Study Center in Canada. But she was overseeing the space, and we had this huge room that was used for storage. And all of a sudden there was a new teacher for the junior kindergarten. I was doing their music. And she said, Laurel, we've come across this money and this space, and let's turn this into a space for early childhood musical play. So I would go and teach the classes twice a week to the children and then set up play centers and play possibilities based on what they were learning and watch them play with the music outside of the class setting and using the research on early childhood musical play. And that was just a really magical time and really informed my practice as an educator.
While Laurel was conducting her research, I was doing my PhD. And my PhD is actually reflectively on a playful approach to integrating live and digital ways of capturing improvisation and using recording devices with dancers, basically giving the autonomy to the dancer. The dancer is holding the camera, recording screen dance material and determining for themselves. So it's the dancer offering themselves how they want to be represented, which flips a previously traditional way of having, say, for example, a cinematographer or a director directing or choreographing a dancer to do this in front of the screen or to the frame. And so the dancer is the one that it is determining how they are to be framed and shot, and they're holding the camera. And while I was conducting my PhD research, playing with these improvisational tools over a 5-year period of time, a practice-based PhD, I also became a mother. And so I started then observing that my toddler was wanting to take risks, climbing trees and jumping from tall heights. And so I also then started doing my some research with early childhood on risky play during the era where we were really starting to interrogate the concept of helicopter parenting and the adult asking the child to stop taking risks. How do we put the child in a place where they are taking risks? That is how they are learning to move and fall and to get back up again, and how important it is for the adult not to censor that or stop that or halt that. And so I also started doing research with my child, who was also in an early childhood center at the time. You know, similar echo to Laurel's experience, watching your loved ones. I was also watching my loved ones. And so that's when I also started doing research on risky play. And ironically, that brings us full circle to Anne Green Gilbert and the concept of brain dance. That's when I returned to brain dance research on what are the movement patterns of the child from beginning to walking, to crawling, to standing, to rolling, to moving, to jumping, to falling. Yes. And so I started working with early childhood educators to coach us on observing our children and taking the cue from the child, as opposed to the child needing to take a cue or a direction from an adult. And while my child started becoming older, so we're looking at our loved ones, I also started observing my parents at that time being in their 70s, and their movement was changing. They were having to start to adapt the way in which they moved, and their mobility was decreasing. And so during the global pandemic, I introduced them to the Sharing Dance Older Adults classes with Canada's National Ballet School. and we were participating together in Zoom dance classes. And I technologically, I needed to be on the phone with my mother to make sure she knew how to open the Zoom, to give all credit to my beautiful parents. It was very challenging for them suddenly to do everything online and on their phones and on their laptops and on their, right? And so I would have my mother on my smartphone while I had myself muted, and I was watching through the frame my mother and my father dancing, doing beautiful port-a-bras, guided by someone in Toronto with Canada's National Ballet School. And my father beaming, and I could hear him, "Oh, this is so much fun." While he was doing a port-a-bras with every other 70-year-old in Ontario who was also in the same class. And I started recognizing the need to bring play back to my older parents as well, through dance, through music and dance. And that then took me into my more recent trajectory, watching my beautiful parents. My research has now shifted into older adults and bringing intergenerational storytelling and play, and particularly moving functionally and through well-being, guided by that experience of us joining in on those Zoom classes together during the global pandemic. And so you might hear in both of our stories that we're looking at being with, living with our loved ones, and taking our cues from the experience of observing our loved ones, and how can we be part of this deliberately, thoughtfully? How can we research this and support this and listen to them to support us?
Well, I mentioned earlier in our program that I had the pleasure of meeting both of you at the recent Healthy Dancer Canada conference, and the both of you did a brilliant talk, which again was entitled Creating Community Through Song and Dance, Variations on Brain Dance Themes. And so, Laurel, talk to us about brain dance. What does that term mean?
Sure. Brain dance was created by Anne Green-Gilpert from the Creative Dance Center in Seattle. And the research is based on the Bartinia fundamentals. So these are patterns that babies do from birth to age 2. And it is a sequence of patterns that we see babies and turning to toddlers need to create to help their bodies, well, so that their bodies develop and function in their motor skills. And so Anne Green-Gilpert took this research and these patterns and developed it into a sequence that she then coined as the brain dance. And I think the advantages of the brain dance are really twofold, not only, you know, developing these movement patterns, but also really helping children and adults with self-regulation, as well as with energy. And it's just this kind of beautiful way to calm and at the same time energize the body and help students build patterns to be successful adults that move. And the research shows how much it helps with reading, with some of these patterns that often when we notice children are lacking certain skills, it really is that they missed these patterns.
What can either of you share regarding mindfulness connection and self-regulation as it applies to children and brain dance?
I'm happy to answer that. So shortly after I delved into the world and research of brain dance, I also discovered mindfulness through an injury I had, but also working with a mental health nurse at the school I was at, in a school of high trauma and neglect. And there is a lot of overlap between these. I mean, I think that idea of noticing one's breath and starting with breath, and the idea of acceptance and working through something carefully and methodically and noticing, and really knowing that there are certain patterns when we start noticing, it helps us connect with our prefrontal cortex. And yeah, again, and it's beautiful actually how these things overlap, even though they're two totally different practices. For me, I've been able to connect the two with my students because I see so many similarities in how the two work together.
And Jennifer, what have you found in your research as it applies to the practices that you have utilized?
Yeah, I'll speak to another age spectrum, I'd say, working with older adults. The beginning with breath and awareness of breath and awareness of round diaphragmatic breath that is warm and open and begins or commences every movement, conversation. So returning back to breath for us as older adults, and in Anne Green Gilbert's progression, moving from breath into tactile or touch. And so touch of one's own body. Yeah. So touching one's own body again, and oftentimes with mindfulness as in brain dance practices, there's very much an emphasis on self-care. Self-love and kindness. And so I have observed that as adults and older adults, having touch and tactile experiences of returning back to touching a heart center, touching the diaphragm while breathing, touching an injured knee that has meant that they've had to stop walking or moving for the last how many years is helpful and thoughtful.
Jennifer and Laurel, what a joy it's been to share space with the both of you today. Thank you. Thank you.
Likewise, Nicole. And if people are looking for where they can follow up some of this work, we're, you know, located in Western Canada. However, if any folks are listening from Alberta, I will be presenting in Lethbridge in January 20th for their school board out there. And that is for the Lethbridge ORF chapter, as well as for the Alberta ORF chapter at Children's Sharing Day in Edmonton in May. And again, at the University of Alberta, I will be teaching as part of the ORF Levels courses, the movement instructor. So really most of my information on upcoming workshops and courses can be found on the Carl ORF Canada website.
I'm grateful to be welcomed by Dance Saskatchewan Incorporated. So Dance Saskatchewan is my new home as well. And Academia EDU is where my publications are posted. And my academic profile is there as well.
Fabulous. Fabulous. Well, thank you again to the both of you for sharing space and time with me today. I look forward to the opportunity of getting a chance to embrace you again.
I know.
Yeah, we do.
Yes. Thank you, Nicole. It's such a treat to see you again.
Have a wonderful holiday, and may 2025 bring you lots of joy.
Ah, oh, I receive it. Thank you, and joy to the both of you as well.
Thanks.
Happy holiday.
Happy holiday.
Happy holidays.
Today, you've been listening to the sounds of Cannonball Adderley with Autumn Leaves and John Coltrane with Blue Train. Welcome back to Turnout Radio on CIUT 89.5 FM. That was Laurel and Jennifer Nicolai. What a pleasure. What a pleasure it was to sit down, share space, and conversation with them both. Folks, if you missed the top of the interview, we invite you to visit turnoutradio.com, CIUT.FM, and some of your favorite podcast platforms where the interview will soon be streaming. I wish you all a happy, joyous, safe, and love-filled season that brings you all that you need. From all of us at Turnout Radio, happy holidays, season's greetings, and we look forward to having you join us again next week right here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Nicole Inika Hamilton. I hope your week finds you turning out to dance. Thank you.
Thank you.